Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Pacelli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, a milestone has been reached. For the first time since numbers have been taken, the number of uninsured Americans has dropped below 10%. Wow.
That is actually quite a milestone. And according to the National Center for Health Statistics, the percentage of uninsured Americans has dropped to 9.2% in the first quarter of 2015. That's down from 14.3% during the same time in 2013. And the first time the national uninsured rate has fallen this low.
And that dovetails off of an uninsured rate at the time of the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, Margaret, that was around 18%. That's a dramatic improvement in a very short number of years.
Well, remember that the measures in the ACA provided tax subsidies for Americans who qualify to offset the purchase of insurance, and that has helped millions of Americans afford coverage, a measure that was upheld recently by the Supreme Court. And the expansion of Medicaid has created the most dramatic difference for certain sectors of the population who had so long been the most likely to be uninsured.
That's true, Margaret, and our work's still not done. The nation's Hispanic population has seen the highest rates of uninsured in their population. Their rates dropped from over 40% uninsured in 2013 to 26%, but still a long way to go, but significant progress there. African American population uninsured rate dropped from 26% to around 15%, and those rates were noticeably lower in states that expanded Medicaid.
Well, that's right. And of course, we also have to remember the elimination of being able to deny coverage for prior conditions also went out the window with the ACA, and that has made a big difference. And of course, access to insurance coverage and healthcare services is just one piece of the nation's healthcare puzzle. We still face one of the big threats to American health, and that's the nation's obesity problem. A third of adults and the nation's children are grappling with overweight or obesity, costing the nation an estimated $1 trillion in healthcare costs.
Something our guest today is working to combat, Margaret. Dr. John Lumpkin is Senior Vice President of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, overseeing the foundation's effort to combat childhood obesity. Dr. Lumpkin will discuss the progress that's being made across the country to confront some of the contributors to the problem, poor diet and a lack of exercise.
And Dr. Lumpkin has some promising news about how the First Lady's Let's Move campaign and the administration's support for overhauling school luncheons across the nation are truly starting to have an impact. Food for thought as the nation's children head back to school.
And Lori Robertson will stop by. The managing editor of FactCheck.org is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. John Lumpkin of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. In an effort to combat the rising tide of heroin overdoses in this country, the White House has announced a plan to target the epidemic. According to the Centers for Disease Control, roughly 150,000 Americans have died from an opioid prescription drug or heroin overdose in the past 10 years due to the highly addictive nature of the painkillers and the relative cheap price of the street heroin. The White House program would shift the agenda from prosecuting addicts to getting them into treatment and would set aside $2.5 million for additional drug enforcement agents to combat the stream of heroin coming into the nation's streets at their source, the suppliers of the drug dealers. Heroin overdoses have quadrupled between 2002 and 2013, leading the CDC to urge physicians to think twice before prescribing prescription opiates to patients, which for some become instantly addicting. Meanwhile, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the use of opioid painkiller OxyContin in patients aged 11 to 16 who haven't benefited enough from alternatives. The long-acting drug already treats adults suffering from around-the-clock pain and has been reformulated over the years to combat that rising prescription drug abuse in the U.S. Unlike adults, doctors are to prescribe the medicine only for children who can already tolerate a minimum dose of 20 milligrams of oxycodone, the active drug ingredient in OxyContin. Falls are a leading cause of injury in older adults, and researchers say for those with a common lung ailment, the risk increases significantly. A study looked at fall rates among seniors suffering from chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder and found that those with COPD are more likely to suffer from falls if they also have other medical problems, previous tumbles, or a longer history of smoking. 40% of the patients had at least one fall, and most people who fell did so more than once. Researchers focused on 41 people over 70 years old with COPD, a condition making it difficult to breathe. Past research has linked COPD to increased risk of balance difficulties, muscle weakness and thinning bones, blackouts and falls. This study lends more weight to those findings. And trying to get pregnant, you might want to skip the overtime or that heavy lifting gig for a while. Study shows that women who work in heavy lifting scenarios or work longer than 40 hours a week have a harder time getting pregnant. A study of 1,700 nurses seeking to get pregnant showed those who routinely engaged in heavy lifting or long work hours, 16% of them still weren't pregnant after 12 months, and 5% weren't pregnant after 2 years. Those women who worked less than 40 hours and didn't engage in frequent heavy lifting got pregnant 20% faster than their counterparts. And for those sleep-deprived night shift nurses, the news was actually better. Didn't seem to have an impact on the ability to conceive. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Lumpkin, Senior Vice President and Director of Targeted Teams at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the largest foundation in the nation dedicated to improving health and healthcare. Dr. Lumpkin is responsible for all management aspects of the RWJ Foundation's childhood obesity and several other teams. He is an emergency medicine physician, having taught at medical school at the University of Chicago. Dr. Lumpkin served as the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health for 12 years. He's chairman of the board of directors of the Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital, the major teaching hospital of Rutgers University. Dr. Lumpkin is a member of the Institute of Medicine. He earned his medical degree from Northwestern University and his MPH from Illinois University. Dr. Lumpkin, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I think most Americans know that we are facing an obesity epidemic, but I'm not sure they're aware of all of the implications. And it's especially troubling for the nation's children. 35% of the nation's children are obese or overweight. And there are also disproportionate rates of obesity facing racial and ethnic minority populations. In fact, the epidemic is so alarming that analysts predict this is the first generation that will have a lower life expectancy than their parents. Tell us more about the scope of this public health crisis and the risk factors for obese children today and the toll it's taking on our healthcare.
I started out in medicine many decades ago, and when I was taught, I learned about two types of diabetes: juvenile onset diabetes and adult onset diabetes. And pretty much you saw one in kids,
right,
and you saw the other in adults. Now we talk about type 1 and type 2 diabetes, because what used to be adult onset diabetes, we're seeing now kids in their early teens.
Hmm.
And this is a direct result of this epidemic of childhood obesity. You know, we have seen the rates of obesity over the last 30 years have tripled among adolescents and quadrupled among children 6 to 11 years old. This generation, the one who are the future of our nation, are at risk of being the first generation to live sicker and die younger than their parents.
Well, Dr. Lumpkin, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation just announced a sizable commitment to a program that began back in 2007 to tackle childhood obesity. Tell us about some of the specific goals that you've established with the childhood obesity program at the foundation and some of the results and the outcomes that you're seeing so far.
Well, we started out actually in childhood obesity in 2003. And as we began to work there, we realized that the critical focus at that time was to do a few things. One, we as a nation believed, by and large, that childhood obesity was a problem of individual choice. Now the public believes that childhood obesity is a problem for all of us in our communities.
Mm-hmm.
Obesity is purely an imbalance between how much food you bring in and how much you exercise. It's that simple. We need to change from... When I was growing up, we used to think about, you know, young people as being those who are involved in getting up and going. Now this generation is sitting down and watching and eating. That means that we have to change the way that our environment is, where people live. So how we build our communities, how we make available access to fruits and vegetables, are some of the critical components. And what we're seeing today is that the rising tide of childhood obesity is slowing down and even stopping. And in places like New York City, Philadelphia, are beginning to see reductions in the rates of childhood obesity. Children are now having access to more healthy schools, meals and school snacks because of some of the federal policies, as well as the fact that schools are adopting healthier school approaches, focusing in on exercise, recess activities, and healthier lunches.
And certainly the foundation has committed another $500 million to the childhood obesity program to continue to build on the work that you just outlined. And I understand this new commitment of the foundation is going to really focus in on urban neighborhoods where poverty is a key factor. And so tell us, our listeners, about the new targeted approach to ensure that every American child who enters kindergarten enters in at a healthy weight, and how do you plan to target these specific populations?
We're committing a second $500 million between now and 2025, so a total of $1 billion over a generation to correct the problem that we believe has taken over a generation to occur.
Mm-hmm.
Our priorities now are to move from where we've learned and how to work with school-age children to recognize that children, actually, some of the decisions that are being made either when mothers are pregnant or early childhood, significantly stack the deck one way or the other. So the first goal is to ensure that all children enter kindergarten at a healthy weight. That we want to make a healthy school environment the norm, not the exception across the United States. We will make physical activity a part of the everyday experience for children and youth. And to make healthy foods the affordable, available, and desired choice in all neighborhoods and communities. And so this is a problem for every one of us in this country, whether it be individuals who are physicians, nurses, who are in the caregiving professions. But it's also a problem for businesses, for churches, for communities, for social leaders, for urban planners. In order to make progress, we need to focus our efforts where the biggest challenges. And the biggest challenges are also the communities that tend to be poor. And so we're going to focus our activities there. And then our last priority is to eliminate the consumption of sugared sweetened beverages among children under 5 years of age. The evidence is clear that children start using sugary beverages at that age, their risk for obesity and overweight goes up dramatically. And part of the problem is parents don't really understand what is healthy and what's not healthy. So we have to help parents understand what puts their children at risk and what's healthy drinks.
Well, Dr. Lomka, maybe you could highlight some of the programs that you and the foundation have observed to really work, to make a difference. And I know there are many, but share some success stories across the policy, activity, nutrition, intervention.
Well, I think perhaps the biggest one is the involvement of First Lady Michelle Obama with her Let's Move campaign and with her influence in changing the rules for school lunches. As of today, about 80% of the schools in the country are now in compliance with those new school rules. They've had to remove the fryers and put in broiling units. But the food that is served is lower in fat and higher in proteins, higher in nutrients, higher in vegetables and fruits. Because of these changes, children are actually selecting more fruits and vegetables and consuming more. But we've also seen some significant progress in New York City and Philadelphia, and they're both shining examples of what happens when a whole city decides they want to get involved. There's clear evidence now that children who are active at recess, who are engaged in physical activity, actually do better in academic performance. New York has focused in also on the childcare setting. They've worked with childcare centers to help them understand how to provide healthier foods, how to provide nutrition education, because often if you educate the child, they bring that home. They've looked at ways that childcare centers can increase the amount of physical activity and, most importantly, limit the amount of screen time. And all of this is very important, and we've seen the results that the rates of childhood obesity in both New York and Philadelphia has gone down. Now, Philadelphia has done something that's really particularly special because they've seen, in New York, while it went down, the rates did not go down as much in African-American and Latino communities. And we're doing some studies in Philadelphia to see exactly what they've done, but they did pay special attention to helping increase the availability of fruits and vegetables in communities that prior to this had been food deserts. Definitely they demonstrate that we can begin to solve this problem.
We're speaking today with Dr. John Lumpkin, Senior Vice President and Director of Targeted Teams at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the largest foundation in the nation dedicated to improving health and healthcare. Dr. Lumpkin is responsible for all management aspects of several teams at RWJ, including the childhood obesity teams. You know, Dr. Lumpkin, there are a couple of takeaways. One is that teamwork is the new employee of every healthcare organization. And the second is really the importance of understanding the science of obesity. Your entire initiative seems to rely heavily on teamwork. And you mentioned the First Lady and her great campaign on Let's Move. Do we have real bipartisan support around the whole effort around the food campaign? Any worries from you in terms of having a broad enough coalition for the science of what has worked so far is so important about the school breakfast and lunch programs, how they're really transforming the national realities for millions of children around the country?
You know, I think many of us in our country and the polls demonstrate that people are becoming increasingly befuddled by what's going on in Washington. So for us, we try not to get involved in that. Because once you get out into the communities and you begin to talk to parents and you talk to businesses, you talk to churches, you talk to schools, they can all understand that what's most important to them are their children and the children of those communities. And when you begin to make the statement out in this country that we're all in this together, people begin to see the importance of change. Whether or not it's the First Lady, and certainly she has really championed this issue, but out in the communities begins to be programs like Let's Move. Mm-hmm. And you have organizations that have adopted the Let's Move name as part of their name because they're fully committed to the goals of getting children moving and getting children to have the opportunity to have healthier school breakfasts and lunches. We believe that partnership is a critical component. So we've had some very key partnerships in moving forward. One is one that was started by the First Lady called the Partnership for Healthy America. And we've been a supporter since this was developed as it grew out of the Let's Move campaign. And this has been a really interesting organization because they just had a meeting 2 weeks ago. I was there at the meeting, and we had businesses from across the many spectrums. There were daycare centers. There were food growers. There was just a new campaign on fruits and vegetables that was announced by the produce industry to make it cool for children to eat fruits and vegetables using movie stars like Jessica Alba and even world wrestling stars to say how important it is to eat fruits and vegetables and broccoli. We've also worked with the Alliance for Healthier Generation, which is a partnership with the Clinton Foundation. And they have worked with our support with over 26,000 schools nationwide. And these schools all make commitments to change their policies, to change how food is given, is made available, and to change how exercise and play is available for children. And I've been to some of these schools, and you just can't imagine how much of a change these schools have where the principals, the teachers. I was at one just last month, Westside High in New York City, where the principal actually leads the spin class. And the principal had a big office, and she said, I don't need an office this big. And she converted half of the office into a kitchen, where students can come in and learn how to cook healthy meals. So these kinds of transformations are happening because schools and organizations like the Alliance for Healthier Generation. We're partnering with the American Heart Association in an organization called Voices for Healthy Kids. And this is focused at many of the key components of working in communities and reaching out and building partnerships with WISE and other organizations. Reversing this epidemic of childhood obesity is going to take all the key players in a community. And they recognize, and it's important for them to recognize, as we believe, that we're all in this together. For schools, it seems like it ought to be a no-brainer. healthy children learn better. For businesses, children who are obese are more likely to be obese as adults, and businesses work better when their employees come in every day. And government leaders, because the cost of care of individuals in our communities is based upon how healthy they are, and obesity is one of the major risks for diabetes, for heart disease, for stroke. So if we can begin at a younger age and bring together all the people who really are committed to this because they are committed to their communities, that's when we begin to see real change happen.
Well, it does seem that we have seen a sea change in this area over the last decade. And as we talk about partnerships and politics, I'm reminded always that all politics are local. And I just have such a clear memory of so many poignant arguments in the General Assembly and so forth. Things like, if you take away the vending machines in the schools, you take away the art program and the football team, right? That we had we had linked these perverse incentives. The vending machines were supporting the activities that hopefully would get kids up and away from the screen and out doing things. That seems to have subsided to a large degree in recent years, at least in our local communities. But some of this has really been about a partnership with the food and beverage industry to make a contribution on their part to try and eliminate or reduce some of these calories from the marketplace. And somebody provided me with a piece of background information that the foundation had looked at a commitment from the food and beverage industry to remove 1.5 trillion calories from the marketplace and found that companies ultimately, when they focused on this as a goal, removed 6 trillion calories. Tell us about some of these large partnerships with industry, really with the food and beverage industry, which kind of had a lot to lose in a shift to fresh fruits and vegetables, and how that has continued to evolve.
Certainly. And, you know, I cut my teeth on the campaign against tobacco. And there, the tobacco industry was the enemy, because if you used the product for its intended purposes, one out of three people would die prematurely. This is different. We will not be able to be successful in changing the whole outlook of our country about what's healthy and getting access to healthy foods without the direct involvement, engagement, and commitment of the food industry. And we're beginning to see some changes. But, you know, as a foundation, we really have not been shy about pressing the industry to do things, to do more. But we also believe that we shouldn't hesitate to shine a light on practices that we believe are positive and make a difference. And that's what happened with the Healthy Weight Commitment. They came to us, they said, we want you to be part of our Healthy Weight Commitment. We said, well, not so fast, but what we will do is we will fund an independent evaluation. You say you're going to move 1.5 trillion calories. We're going to follow up and make sure that that happens. And we did fund that evaluation, and we found not that they reduced 1.5 trillion, that they removed 6.4 trillion. And that really was a major important step. It's a first step. But we think it's going to be critical for the food industry to not only realize that it's important for them to change, but it also makes good business sense. And two things have to happen. First is the industry needs to actually believe that it can make financial sense. And there's some studies that are starting to come out that show that companies that market better for you and lower calorie products actually do better financially. And you're beginning to see companies like Burger King and McDonald's and Wendy's, the big three of hamburgers, taking sugary beverages off of their children's menu. Those are all positive developments. But the other piece is all of us who buy foods need to be better educated, better understand what's healthy and what's not, the problems of high sugar, of high salt, of low nutritional value, and we need to demand healthier foods. And when you put those two together, an increased demand for healthier foods, as we're beginning to see in many communities across the country, and the food industry realizing that's where they can make do better financially, then we begin to see a dramatic change. And it requires a different working relationship with the industry than we've had on other issues.
We've been speaking today with Dr. John Lumpkin, Senior Vice President and Director of Targeted Teams at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, overseeing the campaign to reduce childhood obesity. You can learn more by following Dr. Lumpkin at Twitter at JR Lumpkin or by going to rwjf.org. Dr. Lumpkin, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
This week, Carly Fiorina claimed that emergency room visits are up over 50% under the Affordable Care Act. But that claim is unsupported by the evidence and unlikely based on historical trends. It may be years before we know the full impact of the ACA on ER visits. Available data doesn't include 2014, when the law began requiring individuals to have insurance. Fiorina's presidential campaign didn't respond when we asked where she got her figure, but numbers available from the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services Healthcare Cost and Utilization Project show there were more than 130 million ER visits in 2011 or 2012. So yearly visits would have to have increased by more than 65 million for Fiorina to be right. That's unlikely. The HHS data show an average annual increase of 2% over 6 years. And the American Hospital Association's data for community hospitals shows a 44% increase in ER visits over 20 years, from 1993 to 2013. There have been media reports of an increase in ER visits since January 2014, many based on an opt-in internet survey of members of the American College of Emergency Physicians. 47% of the physicians who chose to respond said they had noticed slight increases in the number of emergency patients, while 28% said there had been significant increases. A Stanford University study, meanwhile, found some evidence that the ACA is slowing the growth of ER visits among younger adults, who, since September 2010, have been able to stay on their parents' insurance policies up to age 26. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In the emergency room or the ICU, clinicians are confronted with a myriad of unpredictable medical crises that sometimes can be challenging to diagnose. Most of these clinicians are now communicating with colleagues via their smartphones, often sending images of a patient's unique symptoms or chest x-rays to one another for shared diagnosis. ICU physician Dr. Josh Landy was noticing a growing trend of image sharing via smartphones to crowdsource second opinions from friends and colleagues across the country. But he also was concerned about the potential violation of HIPAA regulations. So he developed an app for that. He created Figure One, a sort of Instagram for doctors in which images can be de-identified but shared across a dedicated social media platform that would allow input from clinicians within their network. Doctors are using the app to communicate not only with colleagues within their hospital settings, but around the world where someone might have superior expertise with a certain condition. The app was recently used to share a chest image of one of the patients who presented with the Mideastern virus MERS. Dr. Landy says the apps get about 500,000 image views a day, with about 80 million total views so far. He sees the potential for this platform only growing as more young digital natives enter the medical workforce. Figure One, a free downloadable app offering secure HIPAA-compliant image sharing among clinicians around the world to reduce the time it takes to zero in on a diagnosis by tapping the collective expert instantly. Now that is a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.